afternoon at 12 o'clock, March 10th, 2020, and you're at Naturopathic Medical Board meeting. I'm Dr. Bruce Sadlick. I'd like to take a moment to introduce from the Attorney General's office, Mr. Larson, and also our Executive Director, Ms. Gail Anthony. And then we'll do formal roll call.
Okay. Dr. Sadlick?
Here.
Dr. Popio?
Here.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt?
Here.
Dr. Rubin?
Present.
We have quorum.
Okay. Let's move on to number two, the declarations of conflict of interest. We haven't received any, and Gail hasn't received any. So we will move on to the civility statement. I'll read this briefly. According to the open meeting law, the board has a civility policy that prohibits any type of disorderly conduct that disrupts the board from carrying out business. Those violating this policy will be asked to modify their behavior inevitably. If they can't, we'll disconnect them from the phone. With the board's permission, I'd like to move on to roll 4A, and if we could, roll that all the way.
Okay. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen? Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell? Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, that brings us into number five. Let me ask, is there an attorney for Dr. Mead?
Yes, so this is Scott King.
How about an attorney for Dr. Goodman?
Yes. Scott King as well.
Okay. How about Dr. Collins?
Yes, Steve Mahaffey representing Dr. Colleen.
Okay. Mahaffey,
and then anyone with Dr. Reed.
All right, so let's go ahead. We'll call it number five. We'll go ahead and start with 5A. Case number 21-207, Dr. Wilfred Mead. And this is his initial interview. So, Gail, could you give us an overview?
Yes. Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, on 11/24/2021, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a complaint from two physicians at Valley Wise Hospital after providing medical care to CM. The physicians alleged respondent had been prescribing large quantities of controlled substances to CM, including combining benzodiazepines and opioids, along with Xanax, Zyhydro ER and Paxil, and not for appropriate medical purpose. In addition, the prescriptions are being provided to CM as, quote, a favor, and that respondent is a reported friend of the family. The complainant included a copy of the CSPMP report run by the complaining physicians. The report encompasses date range 11/4/2015 through 11/4/2021. The report reflects respondent wrote 215 prescriptions during that time frame, with some including up to 5 refills. Respondent admits he had been prescribing medications to CM since November 2015, including opioids, benzodiazepines, and antidepressants. And that, quote, initially, the only reason I took the case was that she was a family friend, end quote. According to respondent, he began treating CM in November of 2015. Respondent's medical record for CM consists of the following: an intake form and chart note dated 9/11/2015, a quote-unquote triage note dated 12/9/2015, indicating he spoke with patient and husband. Progress notes dated 2/18 of 2016, progress notes dated 8/2 of 2017, and a treatment plan dated 9/13/2021. The remaining documents are scripts and refills. One prescription copy in the file dated 8/14 of 2018 is written for a person by the name of Mr. Phillips. No physical examination is recorded with the exception of vitals on the first date of visit in 2015. No labs were ordered. No CSPMP copies are included. It is unknown if respondent ever looked up the prescribing history of CM. No prior medical records are included in the file. There is one copy of a referral for an MRI dated 7/14/2021, but no MRI results, and one letter dated 6/26/2021 for approval of a quote-unquote service dog. Respondent signed the custodian of records document presented to by the board indicating that he had provided the board with the complete record for CM. As part of the investigation, board staff ran a CSPMP on respondent. Based on the results, five patient records were subpoenaed. The review of those records are outlined in this investigative report. The case encompasses patients from respondent's own practice, patient CM, FM, and KE, and patients from MedShape Weight Loss Clinic, patient SG, LD, and MA. During the investigation of this matter, it was discovered respondent also acts as a medical director for several weight loss clinics. The original complaint related to patient CM. In review of the complaint, the hospital records, respondent's medical charts for patient CM, the CSPMP, and the written response, it appears respondent may have inappropriately been prescribing medications, including controlled substances, to CM. After review of the CSPMP, additional records were subpoenaed. The records for FM, which appear to be the husband of CM, may also reflect a history of inappropriate prescribing on the part of respondent. Records for KE indicate respondent had been treating her for years with only two lab reports included in the chart from 2016. The CSPMP reflects six phentermine prescriptions and one Tympanil prescription and one carisoprodol prescription for SG, who also happens to be the CEO of MedShape Weight Loss Clinic, where respondent serves as the medical director. According to respondent, he trusted SG to order supplies for the clinic under his license. He does not screen the orders, and he made it clear he would not prescribe phentermine. Copies of the prescriptions are included in the board packet. The CSPMP reflects two prescriptions for LD, one for phentermine and one for testosterone. According to respondent, he did not prescribe anything for LD. The CSPMP reflects a phentermine prescription for MA. According to respondent, he has never seen her as a patient. The documents in this case appear to reflect inappropriate prescribing on the part of respondent. Additionally, although respondent serves as the medical director for three weight loss clinics, he failed to oversee the prescribing and operations of those clinics. There is no evidence he reviewed or signed off on any of the medical records reviewed, and records may not be adequate. Additionally, he failed to review the prescribing practices of the clinic staff using his medical license and his DEA registration.
Yes, I'm here.
Why don't we go ahead, Mr. King, are you speaking for Dr. Meads, or Dr. Meads, are you speaking?
Dr. Meads has a statement, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Go ahead, Dr. Meads.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I apologize to the board for taking up your valuable time with this matter. I want to say at the outset that I readily acknowledge that I am for CM. My sole purpose in prescribing the alprazolam to CM was to treat the patient's persistent genital arousal disorder, which I will refer to as PGAD. I did not benefit in any way financially by prescribing alprazolam to the patient. My sole motivation was to bring relief from pain. I then been in practice for approximately 6 years, and my primary focus is regenerative medicine. I'm not a pill doctor, and usually spend approximately 1 hour with each patient for a charge of $80. Despite my failure with CM, I believe that I am a professional and competent naturopathic physician who has treated hundreds of patients successfully over the years. I attended Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine and graduated with my doctorate of naturopathic medicine in 2014. I subsequently obtained my board certification as a naturopath. Before attending naturopathic school, I was an ordained minister for 30 plus years, and I still conduct worship services as a pastor. After joining a missions organization in 2006, I began traveling and training in third world countries. The pain and suffering I saw is what motivated me to go back to medical school. My passion in helping people through naturopathic medicine. My strong desire is to continue to do so. As I became more involved in this case, I now see that I lost perspective and I should not have written for CM in FM's name. I take responsibility for my poor judgment. I respectfully submit that my treatment of patient CM and her husband FM constitute an outlier of my normal prescribing habits. I saw CM 1 month after I had become licensed to practice medicine in Arizona, which occurred on September 11th. Actually, let me clarify. The date I saw CM was September 11th, which was early on as a physician. As a new physician, I treated CM in a way that I would not do so today. If hypothetically CM walked into my practice today as a new patient, I would have checked her PMP, performed a thorough history and physical, obtained directives from her prior providers, ordered the applicable diagnostic studies, performed a urine drug screen, and had her sign the patient contract and referred her to a pain management physician to help coordinate her care. The lessons learned from this experience have made me vow to never again find myself in this situation. By way of explanation, not justification, I believe it is important to point out that the standards that we have today for prescribing opioids and other controlled substances to patients were far less restrictive in 2015 when I first saw CM. Again, I say this not to deflect my responsibility, but to explain the different standard of care at that time. My attorney has recently provided 162 pages of emails between and among CM, FM, and their family and me from January 4th, 2018 to November 11th, 2021, as well as texts between and among CM, FM, and CM's family and me over the past year or so. I respectfully submit the emails and texts to demonstrate that I have frequent communications with CM and her family over the years. With that said, I did not disclose the emails or texts to show that they serve as a substitute for regular office visits, urine drug screens, a pain management referral, among other things. I first met CM when doing mission work in Africa. CM was one of many people who participated in the mission to Africa, and even though we were friendly, we were not friends. Instead, I considered her more of an acquaintance. On September 11, 2015, CM had her initial visit with me in her home. Her chief complaint was PGAD. CM's PGAD symptoms began on September 23, 2011. Before seeing me, CM was treated with paroxetine, clonopin, and Restoril, which brought relief. She has also been prescribed a variety of opioids, antidepressants, and benzodiazepines to treat her PGAD symptoms. I prescribed the medication reflected in the PMP to treat her PGAD. Because PGAD is a very rare medical condition, I'd like to spend just a moment to provide a brief overview of the condition. The cause of PGAD is not known, but researchers assume that it has neurological, vascular, pharmacological, and psychological causes. Per Dr. Robert Eckenberg of the Eckenberg Institute for Pelvic and Sexual Pain, located in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, PGAD is a pain disorder, not a sexual disorder. Dr. Eckenberg is a board-certified OBGYN by the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Per Dr. Eckenberg's website, he has seen over 1,000 chronic pelvic pain patients at his clinic. Dr. Eckenberg believes that PGAD is a neuropathy that causes nerves to fire when they should not. He states that when a PGAD flare occurs, the patient can experience pain, burning, pressure, cramping, and a stabbing sensation. There is no generally accepted treatment for PGAD, and current interventions focus on symptom management. The unrelenting chronic pain associated with PGAD can be disabling. In the last year, CM's average MME was 24.76, and her average MME over the past 6 years was 38.23. I did not write the phentermine prescriptions for patients LD, SG, or MA. Once we discovered that an unauthorized employee at our weight loss clinic had inappropriately entered the prescription into the system, we immediately terminated her employment. As the medical director for the weight loss clinic, I see my role as ensuring the goals of the clinic are being met, preparing and updating the policies and procedures at the clinic, and discussing any issues at the clinic with the mid-level provider and manager. Again, I humbly apologize to the board for my inappropriate care and treatment of patient CM. In the hundreds of patients I have treated, this is the only one I have managed in this way. I respectfully ask the board to consider that my treatment of CM is an outlier and not indicative of how I treat other patients. I will fully cooperate with the board in its investigation into this matter. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Mead. I've been through your case several times, and my concerns are, and you did basically elicit on your comments back, are high dosing, i.e. 120 quantities of sedatives. Then you took the sedatives and you mixed them with opioids. And my concern is you're dealing with medication that really and ideally aren't supposed to be used together, as you well know, and the quantities of the medication, and then your lack of doing proficient self-notes, laboratory serology. I'm perplexed on how this, you explained on how this happened. However, you are aware of the amount of medication, the quantity that you gave this person, correct?
Correct.
And your logic for giving someone 120 of a sedative, what was the logic of that?
Was that for a duration of 30 days?
It was for 120 tablets, 1 milligram, and you had 5 refills on that.
Right.
5 times 120. That's quite a quantity of a sedative. Basically, as you well know, pharmacologically, that patient could very well overdose on that type of medication at that quantity and with the amount of refill. So my concern, and I'm going to ask the other doctors and our public members, my concern is that you just weren't watching what you were doing with these patients. So,
well, with regard to, go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
Well, with regard to the 120 quantity, if I'm correct, I think you're referring to the alprazolam, which is a 1 milligram tablet.
Correct.
120 would give her 4 1 milligram capsules per day, which was 4 milligrams for 30 days supply. That was the instructions I gave her. That was the intent.
With 5 refills, what was your intent on following up in between the time?
So the refills were meant to allow her to refill them monthly and not before. So she would have a supply, an ongoing supply. She did not, I lived a distance from her, so it was a little simpler just to put refills in. Looking back, it may not have been a good choice.
Okay, let me go roll to my other board members. Dr. Brookfield, do you mind if I roll on to you?
Yeah, in retrospect, I agree that my intent was to control her pain, but I now admit that what I did was wrong.
No, I understand that. Dr. Peel, go ahead.
I think just a continuation, Dr. Meads, of what Dr. Stradovic was saying is that I understand from your statement that this is a outlier, but, you know, you've got the first concern, which is this is a friend or family member. So, you know, it seems like the antenna of, okay, I need to be super diligent on this, watching everything, seeing how it goes, because you're already kind of in a gray zone as far as is there even any legitimacy to prescribing to a friend or family member? And then the type of medications that are being prescribed, you know, create that second level. So I understand that this is an outlier, and given that was the case, it would seem like you would have gone the other way of super diligent monitoring, following up, labs, et cetera. You know, I guess I just would have thought you would have gone the other way towards micromanaging it, given it isn't what you do a ton of and isn't your specialty from what you're saying. I just don't know why you wouldn't have gone the other way towards, you know, covering all your bases, documenting everything, forcing office visits, et cetera, versus just saying, you know, we're getting communication via text or email. So it's not exactly a question, but just kind of more of a statement of I'm concerned that you made the choices to treat her, but more concerned that you weren't doing a ton of, you weren't doing much of any follow-up visits or care to legitimize the treatments you're giving her.
One of the challenges I faced in treating this patient, first off, let me say she wasn't really a friend. She was an acquaintance. We had met a few times, and that was all I knew of her. But that acquaintanceship, I think, did appeal to my compassion to some degree. And it may have caused me to have kind of lost my perspective and my sense of direction. One of the challenges with dealing with her is that she would not leave the house. If she ever left the home, she would have a flare of her PGAD that would last 3 to 5 days. And she had basically decided to be housebound because of that. So it made a real challenge in trying to manage her. I was actually, like, my initial visit was in her home, and then I visited a few other times. But she would not come to my office. She would not go out for lab. It was a challenging situation.
Understood. I hear you. That's all my questions for right now, Dr. Stradovic.
Thank you. Ms. Tippett?
I don't have any questions.
Ms. Gallen?
No questions.
Dr. Campbell?
Thank you. Dr. Meeks, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I guess my concerns would echo the two board members who have already spoke with you. And I'd like to kind of take a broader perspective regarding a patient who presents in this way and discloses to you that they're essentially homebound. And the potential seriousness psychologically that you have somebody that is in a fragile mental state on top of the concerns that were already voiced with respect to the issue long term about the patient. establishing right from the start that you recognize there's an issue. You're now, you're in position, you're going to make recommendations, paramount of which is to immediately get herself in a pain specialist, make an appointment with a psychological provider, and move forward from there. And so in other words, you're extending that olive branch just enough to get her that relief, hopefully, but not crossing any barriers, and at the same time making sure that reaching out to the right people and can navigate forward in a better way. Now, ultimately, when you take the psychological into perspective, by providing her with that amount of medication, for which, to respect, essentially what handed her,
Dr. Campbell, this is Scott King. You're breaking up a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. King, for letting me know that. How about now? Is this any better?
It's perfect. Thank you.
Very good. And so by handing her a 5-month supply, we're essentially allowing her now to just kind of nestle into her problems comfortably now, and could cause some pretty significant emotional and psychological damage. Does what I'm saying make any sense to you?
Yes, it does. I agree.
So now, okay, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, essentially, our concern here is if we had a similar situation arise today, you know, what are we gonna do?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned earlier I was a new doc, and I realized at this point in my journey that that was inappropriate and not correct. A factor that plays into this was I was in constant communication, not only with her, but with her husband, who was strongly involved in the management of her medication. He would actually control the parcel and yard of it to her in the home. So it wasn't, I feel like there were some controls in place, albeit they may not have been the best controls.
Okay. And all right. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have for right. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Dr. Spatz, let me move down my list with you.
I don't have anything to add. I think you both have to say what needs to be said. Thank you.
Dr. Rubin.
I'm here.
Can you give me your opinion?
I can, but I have some questions for Dr. Mead. Dr. Mead, talk to us a little bit about the pharmacology of those drugs you were using, those prescriptive agents, pharmacokinetics, including what you know of half-lives, kind of the how they work biochemically in the body and how they may sort of interconnect.
Well, you're pushing me back to my school days.
No, I'm not. I'm pushing you back to the case and probably the first prescription you wrote for her. If you can't answer this, then why are you prescribing this? You're supposed to know how these drugs work.
So the benzodiazepines relieve the anxiety and the depression. They help her to respond to the stress of her condition. The opioids tended to work for her in relieving the pain. I assumed her from a previous position, and I picked up his protocol and was following what he had done, and then I was doing my own research to try and make sure I was being safe. Pharmacokinetically, opioids of course, depress the nervous system and consequently distract from pain more than they actually relieve pain.
Okay. How, you mentioned a specialist, I think you said Dr. Eckstein or Epstein?
Eckenberg.
Eckenberg, I apologize. Is he sort of the renowned physician for PGAD?
Yes, he is one of them.
Got it. How does he tend to practice for this, or with this, and manage patients?
Yeah, his treatment focuses on the use of antidepressants.
Like what?
From my understanding, it would be benzodiazepines.
But you're not sure. More
not
like an anti-anxiety or an anxiolytic, not necessarily.
Right. Right.
Do you know him?
No, I do not.
Did you consider a referral to a specialist?
Good question. Because BM was homebound, she wouldn't go out of the home to see somebody else. So she actually refused all of that stuff. That was a part of the discussion early on.
Okay, I just didn't see a note. I didn't see that you had mentioned that in your critical thinking. I just didn't know how much experience you had with PGAD. I don't have any. I read the Wikipedia definition as well that you had given us, but I just didn't know. Like if you, I mean, you're given a lot of meds for a long time at high dosages, and I didn't, not sure you understand the true pharmacokinetics and pharmacology therein. And to echo what the other physicians have said, I think your understanding now of the issues that you put before the board. And so how do you know you, what's an MME actually? I wasn't sure what that was.
Morphine medical equipment, is that what you mean?
I don't know. What do you mean?
Yeah, it's a measurement of opioid intensity, distribution. I'm not thinking of the right word, but it's a reflection of the level of opioids being used by a person.
How do you know that the patient was getting better or not getting worse?
This condition doesn't necessary. I don't know. Okay, so she was my first patient with PGAD. I had never heard of it before, and I was learning as I went. And as I've learned since then, this is more of a controlling of symptoms kind of thing, and it doesn't go away. So I wasn't looking for cure. I was looking for this to relieve pain. That was my motivation.
And so, but you didn't use what the typical specialist used. You used what another physician used. You were inexperienced. So how do you know that what the other physician was using was appropriate? Was that person a specialist, or were they familiar with PGAD? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how you, as an inexperienced, you know, this is patient number one, using enormous amounts of these substances, figured out that this was effective and the appropriate treatment for a disease you had never heard of, were never taught about in school, didn't know how to manage, and don't really necessarily know the pharmacology of the drugs. How did you know that this was the best treatment? Right. Who was not a specialist, who you had not communicated with, or you had?
No, I had not.
Okay, got it. You took the cue from the previous. How did you know that the previous doctor was treating thusly?
I was doing my own research to try and manage her as best I could.
Well, how did you research the other doctor's protocol that you took the cue from?
Looking up research studies.
But those are doctors that you don't know. Those are research studies which may or may not have relevance. You put together a bunch of research studies, and I don't know when you did it, but I'm assuming it was back then. You said you took the cue from a previous doctor that was treating her. I'm trying to figure out how, where that protocol came from and how you got that info.
From her history? Checking her history?
That she took. And you didn't find it strange that those enormous amounts of medicine, you find it curious that you might want to poke around, ask the doctor, maybe get previous notes since you were a new doctor and really didn't know what you were doing? Did that not occur to you? And maybe check in.
Well,
I'm concerned because you're not a, you're still not an experienced doctor. You said you've treated hundreds of patients. You're 6 years in. On your first patient, something, how do I know that you're protecting the public if you, on your first patient, you can't even check in and you're just believing a patient? I mean, how do you know she wasn't just wanting the drugs? And how did you, I'm not saying now, I'm saying back then. I'm concerned. You're out there prescribing these things. You're a medical director of a clinic. You can't even control your clinic and they're writing prescriptions. I still have questions about how you changed your policy. I'm trying to find out, you said you procured them or you took your cues from the previous doctors. You now tell me that you didn't. You took them from her history, which isn't from the previous doctor. And you said you took them from research studies, which isn't from the previous doctor. So do you want to alter your testimony on what you just told me about how you came up with the protocol?
I came up with all three of those. It was a combination of everything.
But you told me you took the cues from her previous doctor. That's what you just said twice.
Yeah, I looked at his what he had prescribed her, and then I did my research, and...
Well, you said you took it from the patient's history, not from when he had prescribed her. And so if you did, so, or Mr. King can answer, I don't know if we have that record. I don't remember seeing it. Trying to figure out what your, which one do you want to pick? You did hit, you did see the record? Did you talk to him or you didn't?
Dr. Rubin, basically what he did is, and he's not saying it too well, but he obtained that information from her past medical history, did not obtain prior records, and then also performed research regarding the disorder before he provided any treatment to the patient.
Mr. King, with respect, he said he took the cues from her previous physician. Nothing that you said nor he said says in truth that he took cues from the previous physician. You said from the past medical history, which is part of the subjective, which is either procured from the patient at the time of the visit or from previous medical records, i.e. hoping that it was from the previous doctor who was treating, who I don't know which was the specialist. So I'm still trying to figure it out. So I'm led to believe that there really was no true cue from a physician. That's what I surmise, unless you guys can tell me differently, or you can say that that's correct.
He did not speak with her prior physician or obtain the records. And if he said that, that was incorrect.
Okay. So did he or did he not take the cues from her previous physician? Yes or no?
Only the medication that she told me she was taking from him.
Okay, so the answer is no, because you took it from her, not him. Okay, so you didn't, so you took her at her word. I'm not saying that that's necessarily what you shouldn't do. I'm just saying in this case, you told me you took cues from the doctor, you didn't. So as a newer physician, you really have to think about where you're getting the info, especially in a case where you don't know what you're doing. That's how you protect the public. That's why this board licenses you. That's why you can be a medical director of two clinics that are writing unauthorized prescriptions. So you said that the husband of the, I think, CW was the one who gave the medicines to the patient or for whatever reason kept track of them and gave them out. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And I think I heard or read that you had written a prescription for that gentleman without that person being your patient. Is that correct?
He is currently my patient. I'm just trying to remember if he was at that point in time.
That would be a good thing to have been prepared, because if we're more prepared than you are, that sometimes becomes a problem. Okay, so he was responsible for these enormous amounts, and are any of the prescriptions you're writing for that person now the same prescriptions that he was responsible for giving to his wife?
Yeah.
Okay. Members of the board, I just want you to listen to that, because that may become a problem. And other doctors on the board are much more familiar with these medications than myself. But that may be something we may want to talk about, because I can't be sure that CW wasn't using some for himself, and perhaps that's why the enormous amounts were being used, especially since this doctor is far from an expert, has only one patient, never contacted an expert, took cues from his own research and not from another physician, and took the patient at her word using these. Plus, how do we know that the patient's symptoms weren't fully mitigated just by staying at home? How do we know that there was truly a medication effect? I don't know that we do. But if she would have a flare for 3 to 5 days, and that's why she didn't want to leave the house, I don't know, maybe she was too heavily medicated. Maybe there was some kind of psychotic episode going on. I don't know. These are heavily sedating neurochemicals that have big impact. And I think there's a lot here, and I think we need to discuss it. So I do have a couple more questions, unless Dr. Sadler, you would like somebody else to speak, and I can circle back.
No, go ahead, Dr. Rubin. Then I'll circle back to the physician members. Then we'll come up to conclusion and closure.
Okay. Dr. Meats, in terms of your medical directorship in these unauthorized prescriptions, you said in your testimony that you read that once you found out that this was occurring, you terminated the person who was responsible for that. What other types of policy changes have you made as medical director, and how are you safeguarding against unauthorized use of your medical licensure?
I've taken action with the director of the weight loss clinics. We've written up a corrective action document that specifies standards that need to be met. I don't have it in front of me, but things like the only person that can prescribe is the owner manager of the weight loss clinic, that none of the staff will be allowed to do any access to any prescription privileges. There are other points in the document.
What does that mean, access to prescription privileges? Nobody has access to prescription privileges. Like they're not calling in meds?
No. Most of the solutions that are used are peptides, vitamins, amino acids. And they do the ordering through the computer. And so I think some of the staff members know how to have access to that. And that's what we're putting in place is practices to prevent that from happening.
Okay.
So
you understand. Go ahead. I have one more question.
No. Go ahead. I just have a quick question. So is your phentermine and all the other medications, these prescriptive meds, do you have these already labeled, bottled, and staff members are going into the cabinet and giving it to the patient?
They come labeled and bottled, and then they're locked up in the fridge.
So who actually then goes and gives those controlled substances? Who does the inventory, number one? Who does the dispensing of them? And then the accountability of where those medications went?
So the owner manager is the one who does that, and she is a nurse practitioner, so she's responsible for that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dr. Rubin, go ahead.
No problem. Hold on one second. Okay. I was getting back to my chair. Oh, so Mr. King or Dr. Mead, this is Dr. Rubin again. Yesterday we received a bunch of communications and documents, I think 178 pages or so of emails. What are those documents that we received? Could you explain those a little bit?
That's an email trail for a period of time. I forget what it is, like a 2 or 3 year period, between myself, Dr. Meade, and the patient and her husband and her family.
Got it.
It was, and there was a lot of communication through email, phone calls and texting. That was how I kept in touch with her. Because of her homebound condition.
Got it. And how come you didn't include those? Where did you get those from?
That's from my computer.
Oh. Those are part of her medical chart.
No, that was an interaction I had with her on my computer.
Oh, but they were regarding her health condition for which you were prescribing for her and her doctor regarding her condition.
Right.
But you didn't think to enter those into the chart as official documents.
That would be true.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Sadalek. Thank you, Dr. Meade. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Thank you.
Dr. Lucille, can I circle back up to you?
Yeah, I just, Dr. Meade, I also had a question. I guess we'll use FM as an example, because these are somewhat recent chart notes. It seems like your chart notes are also tending to lack a full SOAP representation of what a normal chart note should be. We've got a PRP therapy, we've got some ozone therapies. So it seems like it's significantly lacking on details. Do you feel like this is a good representation of what a normal chart note for you would be?
I think that there is definitely room for improvement. I understand what you're saying, and I agree. They're not as complete as they could be.
Okay, and I would echo that. I can't pull up the patient specifically right now, but it was also at the weight loss clinic, the weekly shots, et cetera. Some of the stuff suggested lot numbers, et cetera, but, you know, there's no suggestion of, and there was a bunch of stuff that said, like, oh, you know, B12/B6 or something like that. There's definitely some strongly lacking data and specific, weekly injections as well. I understand you've made a template, et cetera, but that template is certainly lacking in information that would need to be there. What size needle, which cheek, what's the dose, specific information. It has to, and probably need a standard SOAP note as well, where it says what's the actual assessment, because it seems like that's lacking as well. So it certainly seems like that's an area both in the supervisory role with the weight loss clinic as well as your personal chart notes that needs to improve.
Thank you.
And then one quick question that back to the patient's PM. The complainant was commenting on the dosing of the Paxil that you had come up with. Dr. Rubin kind of got into where you got some of these protocols. Where did you get the technically overdosing or double dosing of Paxil beyond the maximum expected dosage range?
Let me see. I'm just trying to find my notes here. When she came back to me from, she was in Banner, I forget, she went in for something or other, for some kind of a drug problem. They readjusted her medications and put her on Paxil 80 milligrams a day. She kept pressing me very hard to move her up to 120, I refused to do it for a long time, and then I did some research that I included in my response statement from initially that showed that higher levels up to 1,000 milligrams resulted in no toxicity. And as I read that, I realized that she would probably be okay at 120 milligrams. So I wrote one prescription for 120 milligrams, and that was all. That was pretty much near the end of our experience, and so nothing else happened beyond that.
Okay, so she was pressing you for a higher dosing, she was pressing you for more mood management or more trying to have the off-label benefit of helping her condition?
Yeah, I think it was for the pain. My understanding, it was for the pain management. That was why she was pressing me with this. Yeah.
Okay. I don't think I have any other questions right now, Dr. Stadler.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Steele.
This is Dr. Rubin. Can I ask a question about that last part of the testimony?
Yeah, please.
Dr. Meads, that dosage study you read on Paxil, what was the duration of that study? I think I looked it up. Was that just a single dose toxicity study, or was that like an ongoing where they're taking that much for a long time?
I'm sorry, I don't have that information, and I'm not going to guess.
Okay. What's the half-life of Paxil? Do we know? Do you have a computer where you could look it up?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just wondering if it's over 15 hours or so. And if that was a single dose study.
21 to 24 hours.
Wow. That's a long time.
And is you going, Dr. Rubin, are you thinking some type of serotonergic syndrome?
I'm thinking that he's looking up, he doesn't know what he's looking up, and he doesn't understand his pharmacology, and that I'm thinking about emotion and happy to discuss it. I just don't know if I need legal advice, if I need to ask for executive session for legal advice, just to understand how to form one. But yeah, I mean, quite honestly, Dr. Stadelak, it doesn't seem like Dr. Mead was a competent physician in this case regarding pharmacology. And there are several things that have come up regarding understanding his medical licensure and use of it and drugs. And he said in his testimony, he's not a pill doc. I believe him. But the evidence is what we have. He's got a bunch of outline emails and this and that. They're not in the medical chart. We don't really know, you know, I don't know how much more there was. Doesn't understand charting like Dr. Papil brought up in evidence here. He might not truly understand pharmacology, but he has a DEA number. He has a license to dispense. He has his, you know, meds in his clinic. He doesn't understand the disease for which he's giving treatment. There's a lot here, and, you know, my concern is for the welfare of and protecting the public, which is why we're on this board. And so, you know, for me, I'm very interested in quite a bit of CE, both in doctor-patient relationship, pharmacology, especially as it pertains to these types of medications, including and charting techniques. And I also think that there needs to be some type of maybe probationary or something with the prescription privileges, so we need to watch over. And that's why I don't know if that requires disciplinary action to impose something like that. But that's, for me, where I think, where my concerns are.
Mr. Chairman, Scott King, may I say something just very quickly, just about the Paxil?
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. King.
Yeah, thank you. I was going through FM's chart, and Dr. Richard Ulrich, who's a psychiatrist, prescribe the 80 milligrams of Paxil to the patient on September 9th, 2021 for anxiety. Thank you.
I think, Dr. Luke, from what I'm hearing, and also from with Dr. Peel and Dr. Campbell, yeah, I think we can come up with, we can draft up a motion, unless Dr. Rubin, you want to go into executive session. You there, Dr. Rubin?
Yes, and I made a silent motion that nobody heard. This is Dr. Rubin. I make a motion to go into executive session for legal advice.
Okay. I'll second your motion, and then a quick roll from the standing, and we'll go into executive session.
Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt? Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, everyone, I'll see you on the executive session. We'll wait for this answer.
I'm actually here. We're waiting on Justin. He'll be just a minute.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, this is Scott King. When everybody is available, I make a brief closing statement of about a minute.
Yeah, Mr. King.
No, we're not on the record yet.
We're not there yet.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Ms. Anthony?
Yes.
Hi, this is Ebony Lallen. I apologize for the interruption. I just wasn't sure as to the format. Since I didn't hear my agenda item call at the beginning, I just wanted to be present.
Okay, what item are you on?
I don't know the particular item, but it's discussing a conviction I had in 2014.
You've got a ways to go, so you're going to have to hang on.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we have Justin back. Would you like me to do roll call?
Please.
Dr. Sadlick?
Here.
Dr. Popio?
Here.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt? Dr. Spatt?
I'm here.
Dr. Rubin?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, we got
Dr. Spatt. Dr. Rubin?
Present.
We have quorum.
Okay, it's 1:22. We're back into regular session. Before we move on to trying to get some closure on this, I think the complaint was on the line. Is the complaint on the line?
This is Dr. Meade. It was me that said yes earlier when you asked that question.
Okay, we thought it was the complaint, so you obviously aren't the complaint against yourself.
Right,
so I guess
my apologies.
We don't have the complaint. In that case, the board members, let's go ahead. And Mr. King, did you want to say one last thing? Because we need to go into deliberation. We need to kind of wrap this up.
Yes, and I'll be very brief, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Thank you. As to Dr. Rubin's point, on pages 46, to 48 of the 162 pages chart for CM that we produced. There is a PMP that Dr. Meade printed when he was caring for the patient, and it includes the date of December 28, 2014, and it includes medications, and again, this is before Dr. Meads treated the patient, for alprazolam, tramadol, lorazepam, hydrocortisone, and by various medical providers, Dr. Monroe, Dr. Kura, and a PA by the name of Nathan Payne. So, and again, we understand Dr. Meads did not obtain those records, but he did obtain the PMP that showed prior medication that she was on for her condition. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Go ahead, Dr. Rubin.
I just wanted to, you know, Mr. King, just because somebody checks the PMP, you can't assert and assume clinical assumption, just say that that was for that condition. Because he didn't take a cue, he didn't inquire, and he had no expertise at that time, but it doesn't matter, that was long before, I'm just saying in general, just because the doctor checks a PMP doesn't mean that those medications were given for a condition, especially if you have no prior records or communication with the previous treatment history.
I understand, Dr. Rubin. Okay. I was just bringing up to say that, you know, he had proof that she was on these medications in the year prior to that he started to treat her. Thank you.
That would be a more acceptable way to say it. Thank you. I'm done. Thanks. Sorry, Dr. Rubin.
Board members, let's go ahead and try to draw some closure. Let me start off, and then if everyone can interject, I would appreciate it. I'd like to go ahead and do a couple things. Let's go ahead and provide a consent agreement. Mr. King and Dr. Meads can review. And if it doesn't get signed within a 30-day period, then obviously we're going to have to move to a formal hearing. But in the consent agreement, we have a couple violations. So let's go through those. ARS 32-15-01-31, unprofessional conduct violation. So unprofessional conduct would be lack of doing physical exam, lack of doing a proper soap note, and lack of checking EMT. Under ARS 32-15-01-31, we come into R. And we get back into ARS 32-15-01 exception therapeutic use. That's really very, very, very questionable, especially on the amount of medication. And then we get back into where we were with the adequate medical records, which was ARS 32-15-01-3. Very, very scanty if any type of records were done. The patient was not referred out to psychology or psychiatry, multiple issues here. So on the consent agreement, and then the board members can help with drafting this, is I would like to go ahead and at least for a year until the pharmacology portion gets stronger, any controlled substances just won't be written for a controlled substance for the patients that he's seen. That would be one. The other one would be a letter of reprimand. And then the question is, does he want to go with probation? If so, how long? So those are some of the things I have on the table I need to get board members.
Mr. Chair,
I
apologize. This is Justin with the AG's office. I just wanted to clarify when you mentioned that his prescription privileges would be restricted with regard to controlled substances. You meant that that would be a term of the probation, right? Because you said that. And that wasn't, just so I understand, that wasn't a motion. You were just raising that all out for discussion?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, Dr. Papil.
Oh, no worries. Dr. Stavis, the first statement you made was you were thinking that restricting ability to prescribe controlled substances is something you're interested in?
I would be, Dr. Papil, because I just
want to make sure that if, when and if he does go back to prescribing these medications, he's got good justification. He's got soap notes to back up why he's doing it.
Gotcha.
That would probably take about a year by the time he learns soap format, et cetera.
I just didn't quite hear exactly what you said on that first part. What would you be more inclined to restrict opioid benzos, maintaining the ability to do testosterone or things like that?
I'd be open to that.
Dr. Means, is that a part of your practice at all?
Yes, it is, actually, and I would appreciate being able to maintain those patients. Thank you.
Do you prescribe testosterone, Dr. Means?
I do, but I only have a handful of patients, probably less than 10 of them.
And you still prescribe it sounds like you still prescribe the phentermine.
I have never prescribed phentermine. And I do not prescribe it now. I will not.
Okay. So, Dr. Peel, go back to then the benzodiazepine and the opioid category.
My thought would be, just off the top of my head, my thought would be maybe a six-month restriction on those prescriptions during that time, getting the CEUs done related to those categories of interest related to with the prescriptions and, you know, so my thought would be 6 months restriction on benzodiazepines and opioids, and during that time, the additional CEUs that we're going to be requiring would have to be completed in order to resume prescribing those medications.
Board member, staying on one subject here at a time, on the prescriptive, because remember we're doing a letter of consent. On the prescriptive portion, does anyone else have any opinions on it?
This is Dr. Rubin. Dr. Meads, you said you would appreciate being able to continue monitoring and treating your patients. I didn't know what that was in reference to. Was that benzos and codeine?
No, that's strictly the testosterone patients.
Got it. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Sadalek. I wasn't in the camp of restricting. I was more in a long term. I was thinking about 24 months of some type of probation without restriction, where there had to be some reporting or oversight. But I think I was thinking long term, because it's not a part of this practice. We don't know who's going to walk in or how that's going to look. And so that's where I was sitting. And it could certainly be both. There could be a restriction, but when he gets to see used and when he jumps back, where the board might not be sure that it's going to be adequate or that he learned a lot. And so we might want to check in. I'm not trying to create too much work for board staff, but I just have concern with the lack of pharmacology, especially as it pertains to one case, one time, preparedness and understanding this with things. I just have deep concerns. Now, he says he's not a pill doctor, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't have the ability to prescribe them. So sticking with pharmacology, I appreciate if the board agrees with me or is interested, you know, some kind of more long-term monitoring.
So you're thinking long-term monitoring, you're not thinking of restriction like Dr. Peel and myself brought up.
I have obviously crossed my mind in terms of restriction, and I don't know that restricting gets the job done, but it may protect the public, and so I see the reason why he gets his CEUs done, so that does make sense to me. I hadn't really put it together like that, and so I'm certainly open to that, but I do think that long-term monitoring is something. I don't think it's 6 months. It's just that we're done.
Okay. Then you want him to have a longer restriction time on his benzodiazepine and opioids?
This is Dr. Rubin. I don't. I thought it was a great, great timing to ask the respondent to consent to whatever CEUs we're going to impose and have those done in the time of the probationary period, should we impose the probationary period. And then those restrictions, if there are restrictions, would be lifted. But we, the board, would continue to monitor in some way, and I'm not sure what that looks like. I need help with this.
Okay. So let me go ahead and kind of verbally put this together, and then let's, if we need to change, then let's change. But just for the sake of time.
Mr. Chair, members, this is Justin. Just, you know, for purposes of organization, you might want to just do two motions, you know, one motion to offer a consent agreement with, you know, findings of fact and conclusions of law, and you can, you know, vote on that motion. And then after that, you can decide on the disciplinary, you know, what disciplinary order you want to include in the consent agreement. So that might be easier to break it up into those two motions.
Okay. Let's do that.
Mr. Chair, apologies. This is Justin again. You know, you can also just reference the, you know, the facts and the factual and legal allegations in the investigative report, which I believe cited all of those statutes.
Right. Okay. Oh, part of this is going to be ARS 32-15-0131, unprofessional conduct as in the investigative report. That's going to be the one of the findings of fact. Then the prescriptive obviously is a problem. I was going to go a little longer, Dr. Peel, it's at 6 months. I'd like to propose 6 months, basically banning.
Let's do one motion on, you know, the findings of fact and conclusions of law. It sounds like you might just want to, you know, make a motion to offer a consent agreement with findings of fact and conclusions of law consistent with the factual and legal allegations in the investigative report and the discussion today. Does that make sense? And then, you know, that can be the first motion, and then you can discuss the disciplinary portion.
Okay. So let's make that one motion. Findings of fact, conclusions of law, under ARS 32-15-0131, special conduct for the investigative report and findings of the fact. That's one motion.
Mr. Popio, I second that motion.
Gail, can you do a roll call?
Yes. Dr. Stadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye. Aye, just Dr. Rubin, aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, and then for the other items that we need tucked into the consent agreement, let's go ahead and start with prescriptive. Dr. Popio brought up 6 months. I was thinking longer. I'm open on that. Dr. Rubin, you had different thoughts. That's probably Dr. Campbell does, and maybe Dr. Spatt. So we need to come up to closure, please, on his prescribing ability for controlled substances.
This is Dr. Campbell. Does he work with any other physicians in his practice, or is he just solo?
Dr. Mead, Dr. Campbell had a question for you.
Yeah, I work solo.
And do you have any regular and ongoing contact with any other licensed naturopaths? naturopathic physicians that you have easy contact with throughout the week?
Yes, I have two or three that are, you know, colleagues that I consult with when I have questions.
Are any of those two or three mentors, or are they, in other words, more experienced, or are they about the same or less than experienced than you?
One of them for sure is more experienced. I met him when I was doing training in school, so he graduated in 2002, I think, so he's quite a bit ahead of me.
Okay. That's what I needed to know. Mr. Chairman, I just to throw this out there, I wasn't sure if, you know, after, if we've got two levels of thinking, one that's shorter and one that's longer, if we were able to come to a happy medium and maybe do some type of initial restriction, but then once his proof of sufficient CME that everybody decides is appropriate is done, that for a specific term, that you know, that he is able to get to have a senior naturopathic physician sign off on his chart, you know, and we can word whether or not that's prior to you know, writing the prescription or whatever. I don't know if that's possible, but you know, just so that it's his ability isn't limited for so long without appropriate recourse to be able to move forward.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, and what I'm trying to do too is make it easy for him to understand and also easy for our executive director, because she would be in charge of monitoring him.
I see. Makes sense. Okay.
Can we come up with a clean closure on the prescriptive abilities? And Dr. Peel or Dr. you know, Rubin, if one of you wants to tackle the prescriptive abilities, then how we can move on that, that would be appreciated.
I guess, can we take a quick roll call or just a quick summary of the board members? You know, let's assume we're kind of looking at prescriptive restrictions. You know, I guess let's hear, are we in favor of 6 months or 12 months, potentially? I guess I'll start. I vote for six.
Okay. You vote for six. I vote for 12. I think Dr. Rubin, I don't want to put words in your mouth. You didn't want restrictions, correct?
This is Dr. Rubin. It's not that I didn't want restrictions. I just hadn't conceived of it like that. It was Dr. Rubin. I do agree with the six-month restriction, just not with testosterone. I don't see a reason to restrict testosterone.
Okay. Dr. Spatt, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree with the six-month restriction on his ability to write for opiate medication as well. But I agree with Dr. Rubin as well regarding about how who able to monitor other medication that he's going to prescribe to other patients. So that's my concern for the public safety as well.
Okay. Well, it unfortunately probably falls back on our executive director to monitor. But so far we got 6 months. So can we get is everyone? Someone on basis with 6 months? Sounds like we are. So I'll make a motion then for the consent agreement. Dr. Papil, that was actually your idea, so I'll let you go. You roll it in 6 months.
Okay.
Dr. Sadler, so I have a quick question. Hi, this is Karen Tibbetts. I just have a quick question. So with that 6 month restriction, and have we just not gotten to the CMEs, and with the, I guess for me, it's like once that education is done, I mean, will there be monitoring after that? I mean, I get that maybe there doesn't need to be monitoring during the restriction, but I think there needs to be some kind of follow-up once there's additional education, because my concern is a non-physician, the questions that the physicians were asking did not seem to be that difficult for someone who is prescribing medication, that those things should have been known. So my concern is that there's education that takes place following up afterwards with monitoring.
I concur, and that's what the next item we're going to drift into, and I like to kind of appreciate you bringing it up, is the mod is basically all the education he's going to be doing, so he's better off to a better position, and he's better off at prescribing.
Initially would be like 8 hours in pharmacology, particularly opioids and benzodiazepines, and 8 hours in chart notes on top of our standard normal CEU requirements. But I'm obviously open to other perspectives.
No, I think that's good.
Board on board with that, I guess?
This is Dr. Rubin. Whereas I agree with 8 hours of pharmacology, I think it needs to be pharmacology as it pertains more to the case at hand versus learning how to prescribe these types of medications. So I don't know if at least part of those hours could pertain to neuropharmacology or pain management or something along those lines. Dr. Bruce, you may have a better handle on that. I don't necessarily agree with 8 hours of CEs and charting. I do, however, agree with 4 hours in charting, but I would like the additional 4 hours that to take it away from the charting, and I would like it in the doctor-patient relationship. I think boundaries are important to learn and understanding what constitutes medical advice and not. I don't know that this physician understands. It's apparent to me that this doctor doesn't understand, especially because it was emails that we saw that, you know, were within our 4-year limitation that weren't part of the medical chart. And that's unprofessional. And so that's, I would be in favor of a total of those 16 CEUs, but first 8 hours in the pharmacology, and the latter 8 hours split between charting and some type of doctor-patient relationship CEUs, if we can locate those, or he could.
Dr. Rubin, there is already an established 8-hour course in charting, and I believe that actually is available to him through the ADMA. I like what you're saying, but I would like him to do at least 8 hours of how to do a soap note. That's definitely needed, you know, especially the planning portion of that note. And then I agree with your patient, physician-patient professional interaction. That would be another course that he would be responsible for researching in and then bring it back to our executive director, who would funnel it to us.
This is Dr. Rubin. I have no problem with that scheduling, which would be a total of 20 additional hours. So I would then put forth, would you feel comfortable making accommodation to have some of those hours included in the CEUs that are already required? And maybe instead of, because the initial proposal was a total of 36 hours, which, 15 on top. Now, if we're adding another 4, I would be in favor of having at least some of those hours be part of his required CEs hours.
Dr.
Appeal,
Dr. Spatt, your thoughts?
That's fine with the 4 hours of doctor-patient relationship and the 8 hours of chart notes, 8 hours of pharmacology. I think that sounds good. If I missed anything, let me know that.
I think Dr. Rubin was saying that he wanted to trim some of his general CME then. Is that correct, Dr. Rubin?
Oh, gotcha.
Correct.
Well, we could go. I wouldn't be opposed to dropping to 20, 20 hours of standard CEs. I guess, I wouldn't be opposed to dropping a little bit of the standard CEs. Maybe we drop 10 hours and use these 20, what is this? This would be another 24. 20 hours, so.
24 hours.
8, 8, 4.
He's right, 20
hours. From college.
8, 8, and 4. Okay. So maybe we say, you want to say then of these 20 hours count towards the 30? Is that what you're thinking?
This is Dr. Rubin. I think that since there's on the table right now, the offer may be an additional 20 hours, the 8 plus 8 plus 4, like we've been talking about, which we can elucidate, that 8 of those hours would be included in the 30 he already is required, which would cause him to need 12 additional hours, which I think for a doctor who's 6 years in with what we're asking him to do, I think that's very, very reasonable.
That's fine with me.
Okay, so Dr. Rubin, did you want to, or Dr. Papil, did you want to tidy up the senior meeting?
I just want one more piece here is then how we're monitored. So I want to tie that into the motion as well, is the monitoring process there. Are we looking at every 6 months monitoring a PMP report?
Well, I think there's definitely probation, and during that probation period, and Ms. Anthony, correct me if I'm wrong, she will be monitoring him. She will be pulling PMPs on him. So I think at least 24 months of probation.
That's my thought. That's fine. Well, you let me know if I do anything wrong here. I make a motion for a consent agreement related to a practice restriction, a 6-month restriction on the ability to prescribe opioids and benzodiazepines. During that 6-month window, he will be required to complete his CEUs, including 8 hours of pharmacology specifically related to opioids and benzodiazepines, a focus on opioids and benzodiazepines, 8 hours related to chart notes, and 4 hours related to a doctor-patient relationship. 8 of these hours will count towards the 30 hours that are required in total, with a 24-month practice monitoring of PMP reports.
Tidy it up, or are you good for us to take a roll call on that?
Let me just make sure I have it all clear in my head. So the consent agreement, the disciplinary order and the consent agreement will include 6 months restriction of his prescribing, as Dr. Papil laid out in his motion, 24, and then within that 6-month period, he's to complete 8 hours of continuing education in pharmacology, 8 hours in charting, and 4 hours in doctor-patient relationships. 8 of those hours will be included in his already required 30 hours. And then there will be the 24-month monitoring. Does that begin at the time of at the end of the 6-month restriction in his prescribing? Is that how I understand it? Or?
This does. Well, yeah, I would start it now. Obviously, we're talking benzos and opioids, but there are other medications that.
I see.
So the 24 hours.
I think I would start it now.
Okay, so that would start at the same time okay, I got it. Yep, if everything I just said makes sense, then Gail, does that make sense to you?
It does. And Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, I'd like to just go over the monitoring and what I will be looking for during that monitoring process. I understand during the first 6 months, if any opioid or benzo prescriptions come up, that's problematic. That's against the consent agreement. But what exactly do you want me to be monitoring as I'm looking through these PMPs? Excessive prescribing, prescribing of specific medications outside of the opioid and benzos. What exactly do you want me to be looking for? And what will trigger me to bring that back before the board?
For me, it would be you know, long-standing refills. You know, if we have a long-standing refill, you know, that obviously depends on the medication, but, you know, for me, anything past 3 months is questionable because then there's no requirement for the patient to come back.
Okay. Anything else?
And I'd say excessive quantities initially prescribed.
Okay. Anything else, such as combination of drugs?
Yeah, I think then if you could, then when you do check the PMP, make sure there's not a benzodiazepine and opioid combination.
Okay.
And muscle relaxers probably as well.
Right. Don't lock, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. So we've got we've got something out there, and I think Larson helped clarify. Does anyone want to make? I think Dr. Peel made the motion, which was great. I'll second that motion, and then I think we're going to have to do roll call on that, obviously.
Okay. Okay, Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Popiel?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Let's go ahead, if you're okay with it, we'll roll through case number 22-208, and then we'll take a quick break. Or does the board need a break at this point?
Let's keep rolling. Let's go through this.
Okay. So let's go ahead and move on to 5E as a board. This is going to be case number 22-208, and that's Susan Goodman. And Mr. King is representing her.
Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, on December 29th, 2021, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a complaint from Everett Blessing, the husband of patient MB. Mr. Blessing's allegations relating to patient care are respondent performed a neurological evaluation on MB during a telehealth visit, prescribed vaccines for a two-year-old based on a shamanic vision quest, and provided a homeopathic COVID-19 vaccine. In a response dated February 7th, 2022, respondent denies the allegations made by Mr. Blessings. According to respondent, on October 11th, 2021, she evaluated MB during a telehealth visit but did not perform a neurological evaluation. MB reported having seizures, which occurred only in the presence of her husband, as well as limb numbness and shortness of breath. Her assessment of MB was PTSD and hypothyroid. Respondent reports she performed a shamanic journey for MB and Mr. Blessing's two-year-old child, which was performed outside of her role as a physician. She stated she did not prescribe any vaccines from the event and that she has never prescribed or administered any COVID-19 vaccines to any patient. Respondent has supplied the medical records for EB as a result of board subpoena. The complaint appears to be in response to a legal battle between the husband and wife. While the complainant, who is the husband, makes several allegations, the board has jurisdiction only over allegations that reference medical care. Based on records provided, does the board believe the standard of care was or was not met?
Dr. Godwin would like to make a brief statement.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, thank you so much for the opportunity to address you today. Based on my conversations with MB and a review of MB's September 28, 2021, Yavapai Regional had caused the SP to experience psychogenic non-epileptic seizures, or PNES, and suffered severe emotional trauma. I did not base my assessment of MB on an aggravated devotion to MB. MB was and is my patient and not my friend. Also, I did not write an old letter to the community at large, prescribe vaccines from a shamanic event, or prescribe or administer COVID-19 vaccines to any patient. I respectfully ask the board to dismiss this case. Thank you.
Dr. Rubin, can I move down the alphabet and start with you?
This is Dr. Rubin. Honestly, I'd love to hear from the complainant. Otherwise, I'm in favor of dismissal. I don't have any questions. Dr. Gavin's written testimony went through everything, and I didn't see any violation of unprofessional conduct, scope of practice, or standard of care.
Okay. Dr. Peel, I'll roll back up to you, and I'll do a quick roll, and then we'll hear from the complainant.
Honestly, I would agree with Dr. Rubin. The summary was very thorough, and, you know, it certainly seems like this is involving us when it's not necessarily related to medical care at this point.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Thank you, no questions.
Ms. Gallon?
Not at this time.
Dr. Campbell?
Nothing at this time, thank you.
And Dr. Scott?
I don't have anything to ask either, thank you.
Is the complainant on the line?
Hello, this is Mr. Blessing. Although that my experience with Dr. Godman doesn't necessarily align with her version of reality, I support dismissal in this case. She's a great doctor and should stay active in the community. And that's my comment.
This is Dr. Rubin. I move to dismiss the case.
I'll second your motion, Dr. Rubin. And
Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Motion carries. Yes. Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, on September 2nd, 2021, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a complaint from PY, who outlines many allegations. Although in her complaint, PY refers to other patients who have suffered harm from Brio, no other patient complaints have been received. In her response to the board, Dr. Collins addresses each of PY's allegations and provides the board with copies of PY's medical records. PY is a 61-year-old female, presented to respondent on April 26, 2021, with a recent diagnosis of breast cancer. According to PY, she was treated by respondent at Brio Clinic from April 26 through May 21st of 2021. And followed up with the aftercare for 3 months. PY states she wanted to quote-unquote shrink a stage 1 breast tumor and avoid surgery, chemo, and radiation therapy, but saw no improvement after the therapy. It appears PY reached out to Brio Medical and originally had a phone conversation with a, quote, Dr. Larry Hellman. A very limited phone note dated 4/14/2021 relating to the conversation is included in the chart notes. An electronic medical intake form dated 4/13 of 2021 is also included in the notes.
And just for keeping this case straight, is the complainant also on the line?
Courier or Dr. Collins, do you want to respond?
Steve Mahaffey here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know the board, or I believe the board may have some questions. I'll trust that you have read our materials. I will note for the board that there's been no allegation of harm. And in our view, this is simply an attempt to get a 100% refund after services have been performed. And in our view, that's what this case is about. I will also note for the board that Dr. Larry Hellman, who does have a doctorate degree but is not a practicing naturopathic doctor, his position is no longer, it's still with Brio and it is director of education, but he no longer has interaction with potential patients, with new patients calling in. And that was a decision that was made by Brio medical personnel. So with that, I'm happy to opine longer, but you guys have gone long enough, and if you have questions, Dr. Colleen is present and able to answer those questions.
And we've been through this case prior. Dr. Colleen, my only question for you would be perhaps in the future, because there's patient interpretation versus your chart notes, soap notes, et cetera, that the clinic you're with or the clinic you work with or even yourself, to have the patient understand and sign, I think you may even may have had this in there, that there's no guarantees, warranties, no fans, et cetera. So that the patient's real clear that this type of stuff doesn't come back again. That's my concern.
Okay.
And actually physically make sure that they're real clear, because this is where this became problematic. So let me just roll through my physicians and my board members. Dr. Peel, can I start off with you and roll through?
Yeah. I think we covered this once on the first time we talked about it, but remind me if you would, again, there was a number of allegations from PY about her initial conversation with the clinic, what was being suggested, the urgency. You know, do you find any validity to what might have been said to the patient as far as not necessarily promises for care, but you know, get out here, this is urgent, this is aggressive cancer. I guess, do you find any legitimacy to what might have been told to the patient, which made her decide on your clinic versus another clinic?
You know, I don't know exactly what was said to her, as I was not privy to that conversation. However, she didn't, he might have just said more after the line of, you know, get out here so we can deal with the cancer before it spreads, kind of thing, or before it's known to have spread. You know, so if we were looking at it like this, like don't delay, like you have, you know, years of time, kind of. But other than that, I mean, it's really hearsay on my part or guessing, because I wasn't privy to that. But I, you know, as we said before, I did make it clear when she was here on the very first meeting that we had direct to direct, you know, contact. I said, look, at, you know, this is not something that it goes away in 4 weeks. And I wish it does, but it doesn't. That's not what I've seen. And so we're looking for, you know, a length of time that you're going to have to commit to this. And so that's why I had opted. And I said, you know, surgery is a really quick fix. She actually said, should I go back, have surgery, then come back here? And I said, that is something that you can do, or, you know, you can continue to stay and start detoxing your body. You know, there's a lot that we need to change. And I like to kind of look at how a person may have got how they might have got the, you know, the cancer kind of thing. So that's right.
Okay. Well, I definitely understand you weren't privy to the conversation. I just want to know, you know, did you read the allegations from PY about what she's saying was promised to her, suggested to her? So I obviously you weren't part of that conversation. I was just curious if you actually, if you also read her whole list of allegations about the concerns she had about the experience at the clinic.
Yes, and I read them, and I really feel that I clarified anything on our first meeting. That's what I was trying to say. That had she had felt this way, I think I made it clear to her.
Okay, and was there any, there was a concern on her part as to not getting her treatment protocol, et cetera. You may have clarified this on our last discussion, but would you remind me how that process went for you determining the treatment protocol and when she was provided that?
Right. So when I see a patient, I don't have a treatment protocol for them on day one because I don't have all the information. Sometimes they're bringing that to me. So she came on 4/26, and her treatment protocol was done on 5/3. So it was like a week later when all of her labs came in, and I was then able to really direct it especially for her, you know, individualize it. And, but in the meantime, it's not that we didn't give her any service for the first 5 days she was there. She did get stuff based on the little bit of information I had and had read at that time. So, and that's kind of how I came up with what I wanted her to do. So she did have a treatment protocol and one, a different one when she left. And there were modifications throughout based on changes.
So that first week, is that a kind of a generalized protocol? Is that something that was specific to her based on your knowledge of what the cancer was? How do you determine that first week when you are, like you said, waiting for results to come back in?
The first day, for example, I just get some hydration and basically a Myers cocktail. Okay, I don't know. I may not have been presented with labs to know that they have good kidney function, things of that sort. So I try to really keep that at a minimum. The second day, as those labs start to come back, I can give a little more. And like, for instance, I gave artemisinin because artemisinin has properties, antiviral properties, and she had a history of HPV. So that was something that I knew. I also know that the HPV genome can actually be seen or detected in about half the population of breast cancer patients or samples of breast cancer patients based on some research. So, I have to look that maybe there's some sort of viral implication at that time. So that's kind of why I look to do some of the certain things. So it was starting to be modified, but things were then changed later on down the line as well.
Okay. That's all the questions I have for now.
No questions.
Ms. Gallen?
None for me either.
Dr. Campbell?
Nothing right now, thank you.
Dr. Spatz? So
I removed my cell phone, this one, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. And then Dr. Rubin?
Yes, Dr. Rubin. Mr. Mahaffey, you had mentioned Dr. Hellman wasn't a naturopathic physician. What type of doctor is he?
Well, he graduated from Southwest, so he did graduate from naturopathic school, but he's not licensed by this board, and we do not hold him out as a licensed naturopathic doctor. So his doctorate is in naturopathic medicine, but he's not licensed.
But he refers himself to the public as doctor.
Well, he does have a doctorate. I mean, I gave you his bio in our response, and he is referred to as a doctor. So, yes, it's the same as having a PhD or a Juris Doctorate. I mean, anyone who has a doctorate can refer to themselves as doctor. But as I mentioned, he's no longer interacting with potential patients.
Thank you. Madam Director, I have a question.
Yes, Dr. Rubin.
Correct me, or Mr. Larson, is there a statute or a law or something that says that a person who holds a doctor in naturopathic medicine but doesn't hold a license in the state cannot refer to themselves as doctor? Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Dr. Rubin, members of the board. Dr. Rubin, you are correct. They cannot hold themselves out as a doctor, an MD, a naturopath. That's in their statute or rule, and I can get that for you. What I would like to say regarding this issue is if the board has concern about this particular area of this case, they can require me to open a separate case involving Mr. Hellman's use of the credential doctor.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Rubin, this is Justin. The statute is in ARS 32-1555 A2, which states it's unlawful for any person not licensed under this chapter to use the designation, quote, doctor of naturopathic medicine, end quote, or the abbreviation, quote, NMD, end quote, quote, doctor of naturopathy, end quote, or the abbreviation, quote, ND, end quote, or naturopathic physician, quote, or use any other words, initials, symbols, or combination of these that would lead the public to believe that the person is licensed to practice naturopathic medicine. So that's the statute. But I would add, Gail was correct. You know, the board can direct board staff to open a separate complaint involving a complaint about regarding unlicensed practice. And, you know, that investigation only goes up to the point of, investigating whether this person has, you know, engaged in sort of unlicensed practice under that statute. And this board doesn't necessarily have jurisdiction over that. The only remedy then would be to refer the case for prosecution to either the county attorney or the criminal section of the attorney general's office. So that would be the only remedy, you know, for purposes of this proceeding for that part of the complaint would be to direct Gail to open an investigation into that portion of it.
Dr. Rubin, let's deal with her. And then if you want to discuss that at the very end, that's fine, or we could put it into another format. I just want to move through her case number 21-201.
This is Dr. Rubin. I clearly understand it. No, and thank you for that clarification, because that was something that I had concern about. Dr. Sedelec, are we going to get to hear from the complainant?
I asked for the complainant probably about 20, 30 minutes ago. I didn't hear back from a complaint. I don't think we have a complaint online.
Would you be able to make sure of that?
Yeah, I'll put it out there. It's 217. It's the complaint on case number 21-201. That's Colleen. On the line.
Colleen,
sorry about that. Okay, so there is no complaint online. We're trying
this
to
is resolve Dr. it. This is Dr. Rubin. I have no question.
Okay. Any other board members have any questions for Mr. McCaffrey or Colleen? Okay, so we need to make a motion so we need to clear this case. So I'm open to hear a motion from the board members.
This is Dr. Rubin. I move to dismiss the case.
Okay. So we have Dr. Rubin dismissing. I'll make a second. The only thing I would highly suggest, as I said a half hour ago, please make sure that these people realize, again, no warranties, no guarantees. You can have your attorney help you with that. Dr. Rubin has a motion for dismissal. Does anyone want to second that dismissal?
Dr.
Okay. Second. So we need a roll call from the family.
Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Popio?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt? Oh, I'm sorry. You are recused. I apologize. And Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Motion carries. Thank you. Let's go ahead and move on to 5D.
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to make sure that there was some discussion about potentially opening a separate investigation into the unlicensed. Right. Did the board want to do that, or...
Dr. Rubin, did you want to make a motion for that?
This is Dr. Rubin. I need some clarification and perhaps some legal advice on this before I would make any motion. And I can certainly ask my questions because I certainly can, but I would like to make a motion to move to executive session for legal advice.
Okay.
Do I have to do that in regards to a case, Mr. Larson, or can I do that anytime?
Yeah, you can. But I did just want to note, you know, I don't know that I would say anything differently in executive session than I, you know, or anything, you know, more than I already said in open session. You know, the remedy for unlicensed practice allegations is really just for the board to investigate up to the point of seeing if this person potentially engaged in unlicensed practice, and then, you know, if that, depending on the results of that investigation, the formal remedy would be to refer it for prosecution. So, you know, that would be, you know, but at this stage, it would just be, you know, opening a separate investigation into that issue.
This is Dr. Rubin. I rescind my motion for executive session for legal advice, but I do have questions. Mr. Larson, if somebody who holds a doctorate in naturopathic medicine refers to themselves as doctor, that isn't something that we have jurisdiction over because they're not using the word naturopathic medicine, or it's not necessarily suggesting that they're a doctor of naturopathic medicine, or is it whenever you use the word doctor, there's an assumption perhaps by the public if they check in that this person is because they have a doctor of naturopathic medicine, that this person is using the term doctor to refer to their doctor of naturopathic medicine?
Well, I understand. I think, you know, again, I would just draw you back to the language of the statute. It's ARS 32-1555-A2. And, you know, it includes these specific quotations that, you know, an unlicensed person is not allowed to use. But it also says, or the use of any words, initials, symbols, or combination of these that would lead the public to believe that the person is licensed to practice naturopathic medicine. So if you believe that, you know, this might fall into that area of something that might lead the public to believe that, then, you know, that would be a basis for, you know, the board to investigate it just to determine whether you want to refer it for prosecution. Does that make sense?
So it does make sense. Dr. Rubin, is there a way or a mechanism for that without opening a board complaint or a board case that the executive director could kindly remind people specifically with a doctor of naturopathic medicine who call themselves doctor, who are not legally allowed to in the state of Arizona, that they are not allowed to, and that they should stop, or else the board might end up opening a case? Or is that not a thing?
I mean,
I'm asking, can Gail reach out and just say, by the way, we don't necessarily want to do this, but we thought we might want to let you know. I don't know. That's not me directing. I'm just wondering if that's a thing to do.
If I might interject, this is Steve Mahaffey. Dr. Rubin, I can tell you that message is loud and clear, and I will communicate it. I understand if you would want your executive director to also communicate that, but I'm very mindful of the statute that Justin has pointed out. And again, as I mentioned, we have moved Mr. Hellman to a different position where he's not interacting with potential new clients. So there is no potential, in our view, there's no more potential for confusion.
Thank you. Mr. Mahaffey, I appreciate your change in titling within the context of a single conversation, and I see no reason to open a case at this time.
Thank you.
Ruben, are you okay with that then, since Mr. Mahaffey's already got that?
Ruben's good. I'm good, Mr. Deck Ruben, I'm good. Yeah, I'm good.
All right, so he's good. So let's move on to 5D as in dog, and then we will take a break. So 5D, case number 21-206, Dr. Michael Major, and this is an initial interview. He does not have legal counsel. Are you still with us on the phone?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And, Mr. Hampton, can you give us a review?
Yes. Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received information relating to a potential complaint received by the Attorney General's office on their general complaint line. The complainant is a DO who alleges respondent inappropriately prescribed or sold testosterone to his patient, but he did not leave the patient's name. The complainant stated he had checked the CSPMP for the patient's name and did not find it. Based on this, he alleges respondent sold testosterone to this patient without reporting it to the CSPMP. He did mention that patient was seen at a clinic known as Summit Mel Medical. Board staff reached out to the complainant for more information. As of the drafting of this report, the complainant had not responded. According to the respondent, he did work at Summit Mel Medical from approximately September of 2019 through February of 2020. Board staff generated a CSPMP and subpoenaed medical records for 5 patients. Upon receipt and review of the information provided to board staff, a case was opened. The review of those records are outlined in this investigative report.
Yes, sir.
Can you give us your viewpoint on this?
Yeah, I did work at Sonomel Medical during the slowdown. I was contracted there. I worked 2 days a week. First of all, I would love to know this patient's name so I could have looked up his chart. But for the most part, any patient there, any discussion about other doctors they were seeing was to talk about the pharmaceutical cocktail they were on and how that could be harming them. And so I give them my medical opinion, information to take back to their doctor. So it's possible that this physician who doesn't have experience with what we were doing, took offense to that and filed a complaint. But other than that, I mean, it'd be great to find information about this case or about that case. Gail, I think she found the 5 youngest patients that I talked to. Those are definitely outliers. The average age of my patient is 50 or more. But the 2 youngest patients, they were brothers of their father as a patient. For the most part, there was one single case. And then the other 2 were friends. I got to know the one of them. He's a trainer at the gym I go to. They both have been to anonymous meetings for addiction, and they're both doing very, very well.
Dr. Ruben, you want me to start with you, or would you like me to start with Dr. Bofield?
This is Ruben. Hi, Dr. Sadalek. You know, it's certainly not this area of medicine isn't part of what I do during my oncology practice, my day-to-day over the last couple decades. What I really would like to understand, and I certainly hear Dr. Majors that the average age of your patient is 50. You know what? I would love to hear. You know what? I would kind of like to pass this to somebody else, just because I don't want to encumber the board with something that may not need to be encumbered. I would like to go later. Sorry.
Okay. So let me start off. Dr. Major, my question is a 19-year-old male, testosterone level 300+. How do you know that's not his normal baseline? And then by giving him testosterone, because obviously, as you know, you have to check FSH, LH. You want to rule out secondary hypogonadism, et cetera. How do you know that that's not a 19-year-old's normal baseline, normal physiology for that patient?
He was prescribed one 10-week, given one 10-week prescription of testosterone for the sole purpose of getting him off testosterone. Because he had his older brother through their trainer, and you know, I know this family. I've been to their house, and so I in a way trusted them that they were telling me the truth. But this young patient had been given this testosterone from his trainer with unknown quality esters that were too fast absorbing, and what he was saying was that he got great benefit from using it. And he kind of became emotionally addicted to it in addition to the other symptoms when he tried to come off of it. And so what the agreement we came up with is he's been given one 10-week supply of a quality testosterone. So instead of saying, okay, whatever you're using right now, just being off it, I was saying this quality product that we know is safe, you're going to do this regimen for the sole purpose of not taking testosterone anymore.
So which quality product are you referring to? Which of the testosterone, three or four of the injectables, which are you referring to?
Testosterone stimulating from Virtus to Testosterone.
Okay. How often are you taking into account that level, whatever happens to be a 19-year-old, a 30-year-old, a 50-year-old, that may be their normal physiological baseline? And then pushing it to high levels, 1300s, et cetera, which I saw in somebody's lab, you then can enter gonadotropinemia, you can enter increased RBCs, hemodialysis, et cetera. How do you know when you're pushing the limit on the dosing?
The way he was going to be dosing was the daily dose.
I'm talking in general.
So in general, that's the regimen I get people on. The regimen, for the most part, that people start on is they do one shot of 200 milligrams for 2 to 3 weeks until they feel the benefit. Then we bump it up down to half that dose twice a week. And then following the next lab review, we get as frequent and low a dose as possible. So the optimal range that I look for, that I find people benefit from through research, through experience, through my personal use, is somewhere around 25 milligrams per deciliter for the free testosterone. And when they do that daily dose, what I'm finding is they isolate kind of between 20 and 30-ish on their free testosterone. The total testosterone in itself isn't as important unless it's super high and they have binding globulins, and then their free testosterone is just not proportionate. But for the most part, I look for something north of 900 to get an optimal level. And then I look forward to make sure they're not over-aromatizing for gynecomastia, for prostate concerns. I look for the ratio of the total testosterone to estradiol to be at least 15 to 1.
Okay, and then what are you doing? You're 50 plus or even 40 plus. What are you doing monitoring? What are you looking for PSA-wise?
The PSA, I don't know if you know, but John Hopkins is now using testosterone for prostate cancer patients. And my history and my experience, what I find, especially if you keep the frequency high and the dose low, is that PSA stays the same or gets better. And of my hundreds of patients, none of them have prostate issues. So you get a baseline of it, make sure it's we're looking for something preferably below 1, but definitely below 2, and then continue lab work, continue to monitor and look for not just the peer number, but any change. And when people are on that, you know, low dose, frequent regimen, when they're eating well, when they're not doing, you know, when alcohol is limited and other lifestyle factors, PSA is just a non-factor. Or excuse me, prostate issues is just a non-factor.
Okay. Let me work through my physicians and public members. Dr. Field.
Dr. Major, a couple quick questions. So the patient that's the unknown patient from Summit Mail, when you work there, do you guys dispense vials or are all testosterone injections done in-house?
They would work with a pharmacy, I believe it was in Illinois. So if he wasn't checking another state, that could be a reason why he didn't see it listed. When I worked there, because it was a temporary period and I was not going to be a full-time doctor, they essentially used me as kind of a recommendation. And then the prescription was given, the website checked through the staff and through the medical director of the facility.
So there could be a reason why the PMP from Arizona was not showing for a patient who was actively being seen.
I know they checked the site, but the reason why it might not show up on the AZ PMP is because it was from a pharmacy outside of Arizona.
Right. Okay. All right. So another quick question on one of these patients we find it. RT. So this was the 22-year-old. My question for you was on the EAP 1295 and the addition of that to the regimen. I don't see IGF-1 growth hormone. Obviously, the IGF-1 is probably the first starting point, but I didn't see any sort of documentation of growth hormone or IGF-1 level prior to starting the patient on that. I think there's a number of other patients, one or two at least, where that was also the case. How are you monitoring the impact of CJC-1295 and determining whether to start them on that in the first place?
My experience is that CJC with ibuprofen does not increase IGF-1 that much, and if it does, it's short-lived because the half-life of the CJC with ibuprofen comes to be about a half hour. So if there was an increase, it would have to be kind of taken in that period. The way I monitor their using it as prescribed is when they come to me for a refill and then go by signs and symptoms. But my conclusion with these guys is that they are supporting a normal physiological pathway that could otherwise be, you know, optimized with a pristine diet, proper absorption of amino acids and things like that. And so what I'm finding is that this, although you say, you know, it does increase human growth hormone, pathway in which it does that is much different than just being human growth hormone into them. And with where the half-life of that is 7 to 8 days or more, and then you would have a real concern with IGF-1.
Okay, I guess I understand what you're saying on that. I guess, have you ever had a patient inject the CJC-1295 ipamorelin and done a growth hormone test within an hour or so after doing that shot?
I have not done that, no.
Okay. It produces a massive spike in growth hormone levels. I use these products as well, and there is massive, massive spikes in some patients, and some patients not as much, but there are significant spikes in growth hormone levels that will come from the induction of the pituitary pathway. So I appreciate what you're saying about the difference between the peptides and the growth hormone. You are effectively dosing growth hormone. If you do the patient's lab and have them do the shot right before the lab, you will see massive doses of growth hormone, and particularly, I would imagine, in a 22-year-old patient. So the impact on the system is going to be fairly similar, and generally you're going to probably see, you know, you're saying you're not seeing too many IGF-1 changes. I would say I am. So I guess I would just say, if I'm going to be putting a 22-year-old on a growth hormone stimulating peptide combination, you probably want to see the IGF-1 before you treat them. You probably want to, you know, monitor how the IGF-1 responds and then even consider doing, like I just said, seeing how they're responding and how much growth hormone they're making to these peptides. So I'm just wondering, you know, is this a good patient population based on their age to be using growth hormone stimulating peptides and not having any lab values, you know, certainly is of concern as well. I understand what you're saying, that this is somewhat of a symptomatic profile and how you're determining the prescription, but I would caution you that I would really think that labs would be needed and that age range probably, I would think twice about, you know, putting them on growth hormone stimulating peptides, because their response probably is going to be pretty significant. I had a quick question on how you do the nuts and bolts on your testosterone, more so from just a financial standpoint. So I see a testosterone charge, I see some like a prescription charge. Effectively, how does the patient get testosterone? You're prescribing it through a local pharmacy and having it shipped to them, and you're just billing your account for them?
I'm using a Salt Lake Pharmacy in Florida for peptides and testosterone now. So they pay me, and then I pay the pharmacy, and then they ship it directly to the patient. I think I am going to, based on what you said, start adding IGF-1. I guess my question to you is, if it's not added within that, you know, short time period when they take it, and are you saying that you are seeing a spike in IGF-1 hours later?
Yeah, you can. I guess how I've looked at it historically is, number one, it's not a cheap product. And so I tell patients, you know, listen, I want to know, number one, are you responding to it? Number two, how much are you responding? Because, you know, 250-year-old males want to produce a growth hormone, you know, obviously a morning fasting growth hormone level is probably going to be zero for most people. You know, I've seen levels anywhere from 5 to 45 as far as growth hormone production in response to doing these shots. So, you know, and generally you'll see an IGF-1, you know, response. Not everybody, you know, there's obviously other factors that go into the IGF-1 spike, but I always like to see how are they responding to it. Are they actually making more growth hormone? So typically I'll do a test 30 to 45 minutes after injecting the peptide just to confirm that they are responding to it and to get a sense of like, oh, this person is making a massive dose of growth hormone. Maybe I need a little bit less of a dosage, even if my IGF-1 isn't going all that high. Okay? That's just how I determine this kind of be effective. Just kind of monitoring and getting a sense of, you know, how much growth hormone they're making from those peptides. Right?
Okay.
Whether you see a fluctuating IGF-1 or not, I think if you're going to be prescribing something that's going to stimulate the growth hormone, you definitely want to cover your bases by at least having an IGF-1, because if your 22-year-old is, for whatever reason, got an IGF-1 of 200-300, you probably don't have a whole lot of like to stand on.
I totally agree with that. And again, these patients are all buyers. They're kind of my peers. When we talked in person, I gave them, you know, I talked about when I was their age and how, like, you could buy androstenine and at a GNC and how I experienced muscle growth too quick and 10 minutes when cut up. And so the main purpose for them was to get them off testosterone. And I think at least for Rex, we gave them the recommended dose was a quarter of the CBC annual. And that is what I'm telling you, is that the recommended dose of twice a day, 5 days on, 2 days off, is just too much. And so, like, now when I recommend it to people, they take it once a day on days that they're training, they feel like they're recovering.
And did you suggest, I didn't, were you suggesting that a lot of your patients, whether it's twice a week or the daily dosing, but a lot of times you're shooting for 200 milligrams a week as your dose, or was it more like 150 based on 25 milligrams per day?
Well, the 25 was for the pre-testosterone, what we're looking for. And so when I give people on a daily dose, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. I just was thinking what the math was as far as if you're dosing at like 0.12 or 0.15 daily, what does that equate to weekly? Somewhere around 200, I guess.
At least no higher than that. And I try to get them to find the lowest dose in which they feel good. And so when we get to the daily dose, I often recommend they start with 0.1 ml, which would be 20 milligrams on non-training days, and then up to 0.15, which would be 30 milligrams on training days. And oftentimes, patients are able to find a happy medium where they use something like 12.5 milligrams daily, and then I even recommend for them to try one day off, like on a weekend when they're at home recovering. And so in the end, the average patient is probably doing somewhere between 150 and 170 milligrams per week.
I understand the idea with what you're saying as far as fluctuating the dosing a little bit, but are you suggesting you're dosing it higher on training days? What is your goal on that?
The goal is that they just burn it up, because, again, that's what I'm finding with, people who are very active. You could take someone who's a gym rat, and they come in for lab work, and they're going to show their numbers bottomed out, and then you take someone who doesn't work out at all and is kind of a couch potato, and they can have, relatively higher numbers than that person. So the idea being that when they're using it, they can stand a little more. When they're kind of inactive, there's no reason to take that much.
I just, one of the things that, we've kind of come across over the years is just an area of caution, the suggestion of why you're using the testosterone. I guess I would say, whether you're even in communications to your patients, I just would caution you to be wary of suggesting, that you're focusing on muscle growth. I guess you just don't want to be using that terminology, why you're using the testosterone as far as, what I'm saying, I'm just trying to make you be cautious, in how you're terming that with patients, and then, even when you're talking about your chart notes, the idea that, we don't want to be, we're doing this for well-being, sleep, mood, energy, motivation, et cetera, not so much for massive gym responses.
Yes, sir. And I guess I should say more word that as days where you're not active to decrease the dose rather than increase it on days that you're doing. So it's kind of like the 15 units would be more of the baseline, and then on days when they maybe don't need that much to take less. And then really, the one patient who has worked as a trainer, he's really the only in a way, bodybuilding guy. So the average patient I work with is more for, like the things you talked about, for their general health, sleep productivity, mental focus. They're not at all, just in there for the build.
I don't really have any other questions, Dr. Satterlake, at this time.
Okay, let me roll down then let's go with Ms. Tibbetts.
I don't have any questions.
Ms. Gallen?
I don't either.
Dr. Campbell?
Everything's been addressed now. Thank you.
Okay. And Dr. Spath?
Oh, yeah, I have a quick question for Dr. Goodman. So when you do the testosterone, do you also, even for the 19 years old, do you do any PSA tests as well? And also, do you do any physical exam on them as well? Regarding to the
DIE. So the standard patient would have blood work done through my lab. I use Person Choice Lab. And so when they come in, they have notes written on their lab work that I've received. At that point, it does have PSA in it. It does have, I think if you look on two of the patients, it has their Patient Choice Lab within it. The one thing after this discussion, I will start adding IGF-1. And then at that point, we go over their more in-depth history, go into the lab work for a significant amount of time, and then come up with not just a short-term but long-term plan. physical exams, I do check vitals, but other than that, if they have any injury that needs addressing, at that point is when we go over it with the physical exam.
Now, is that with only the 19 years old, or let's say if you have an older gentleman, would you do any physical exam regarding the prostate?
If they do have a high prostate number, I would refer them. My experience with doing digital rectal exams is they are so inconclusive. Even if people do them frequently, they still end up referring them. So, again, I just haven't had a problem with elevated PSA. And this kind of goes back to when I did work at a cancer treatment center up here. They asked me to look into this physician at Johns Hopkins that was now treating prostate cancer with high doses of testosterone because they were considering applying that to their treatment. And what he was finding was, you know, very, very promising. I don't necessarily agree with the dose he gave, but in my experience of the hundreds of patients I get, when you keep that testosterone level optimized and then you address any lifestyle concerns, make sure they're not over-aromatizing, other things like that, they just don't have prostate problems.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you so much. That's all I have. That's all I want to know. Thank you so much.
Dr. Rubin?
No, Dr. Rubin's good. I've been listening. Thank you. Very, very complete.
And then, Dr. Major, I have one question on lab. You did lab tech diagnostic patient TR, Tom Rick. And can you pull that up on your computer, or do you have that in front of you?
I'm sorry, did you say the patient's name again?
The initials are T as in Tom, R as in Rick.
I think it's RC.
RC. RC is creatinine levels 1.4. Estradiol is 0.6. What was your intention on his renal function?
So this was the older brother that he was kind of a gym rat, and he was the one who was getting the testosterone from his trainer and provided it to his brothers. And he was on way too high of a dose, and again, he was on esters that were absorbing way too quickly. In addition, for the amount that he was training, I found that there was insufficient and untimely protein intake. So the goal was to get him done with any trainer-provided substance, to decrease the dose of testosterone slowly, and then to increase the protein around workouts. And again, what I find is that the biggest increase in nitrogen and creatinine away from taking creatine is that they're getting too much muscle breakdown with their workouts because it's insufficient amino acid intake. And so the goal through supplementation and diet was, especially around workouts, to make sure that he was getting enough protein in while decreasing the testosterone level. At that point, we would, if they were still concerned with the numbers, we would look into any possible concerned with kidneys. But again, my experience is that although nitrogen and creatinine can be elevated and EGFR too low, if they are working out too much with insufficient protein, if you address those things, but all of them return to normal levels.
Okay, and did you recheck his lab?
Rex was the one who we rechecked his labs. And what I found was that he was not being truthful or not going with the plan. And so he was the one that I discontinued care with.
Okay. And then you had a plan for his estradiol level?
His estradiol compared to the total testosterone to estradiol level is the biggest concern. is one, you don't want to bottom out estrogen because you have a whole other problems, but you want to make sure it's proportional to what the testosterone is. And so they, all the estradiol was elevated. It was proportional to what his total testosterone was. So the goal was to get the total testosterone down, have estradiol come with it. If it didn't, then we would look to the concern with overconverting.
Hey, if it was overconverting, what was your plan B?
The rare occasions that does that, I do, sometimes provide anastrozole at a super low dose for just a couple weeks. For the most part, I do find increased estrogen with too much alcohol intake. There can be other factors in their diet that influence that. But for the most part, if they are eating well, if they're doing, you know, the right amount of movement with their body, and the I find that they're just, it's over-aromatizing, it's just not a problem.
Okay. And before the board goes into discussion on this, is the complainant on the phone? No complaint. Board members, any further discussion on this case? And if not, then I'll need a motion as to how the board would like to proceed.
Dr. Bocchio, I would like to make a motion to essentially delete this case. Sorry, I'm just spiking on the word here. I would like to make a motion to move forward and just delete the case. Yeah, I can't think of words, sorry.
Are you moving forward? Dismiss,
thank you.
Sorry, I got a baby right now. Yeah,
dismiss the case. If Dr. Peel has that out, does anyone want to make a second on that?
Campbell can second that.
Campbell second. And then at that point, we need
Anthony
to go ahead and give us the roll call.
Okay. Dr. Sadlick? Dr. Sadlick?
Hi. I'll pause you for a moment. Hi.
Dr. Popio?
Hi.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Hi.
Ms. Gallen?
Hi.
Dr. Campbell?
Hi.
Dr. Spatt?
Hi.
Dr. Rubin?
Hi.
Motion carries.
Okay, it is 2:57, and I'll make a motion for 10 minutes. We'll reconvene, let's say 3 o'clock, we'll reconvene at 3:10. And that's the motion. Anyone want to second it?
All those in favor?
Hi. See you at 3:10.
Hey, thank you.